Chapter 21. Degeneration. Souls collide. Dark rebirth. Amon found his father bathed in blood. A storm raged in a lacerated sky, but that was nothing new for the planet of the sorcerers in these troubled times. On a world of inconstancy, destructive storms of ether fire were the only things that now never changed. But this was no natural storm, if anything on this benighted world could be counted natural. It rained blood, and flames burned skywards at the heart of a crude city of fallen menhirs, nestled in the cheerless foothills of mountains carved from smoked glass. Amon Stormbird growled with hostility at the edge of the city, its engines powering down as he made his way through the primitive settlement. A pair of servitors followed him, guiding the golden support throne that had once aided the healing processes of his shattered spine. Blood-matted corpses were strewn everywhere, bestial things of hoof and horn that might once have been men. Their bodies lay in shredded chunks, as though they had been fed into a giant threshing machine. Arcing loops of blood had painted the ancient stones, and Amon saw geometric significance in each intersecting line, every cursive spray. The rain was washing them away, and Amon trudged through sucking mud that bubbled red around his boots. He followed a path of murder through the city, eventually arriving at a circle of hard-packed earth with a towering idol at its centre, a vaguely avian thing with curling, eye-tipped antlers and wings fashioned from beaten metal and driftwood. Where had the beasts acquired driftwood? Standing before the great idol and looking up through the rain in confusion was Magnus the Red. At this moment the Primarch's name was aptly earned, for he was drenched from head to foot in his victim's blood. Hundreds of the slain beasts surrounded him, and his Kopesh blade was slathered with gore. Magnus turned towards Amon, his expression hard to read beneath the red rain washing his skin. The Primarch stared at him for long seconds, illusory breath heaving in lungs that did not truly exist. Witch Magnus stood before him. His father lifted his Kopesh, and with a pulse of thought, the blood coating his weapon and flesh lifted in an aerosolized cloud. Resplendent once again, Magnus hooked his sword at his hip and strode towards him. "Amon," said Magnus, and he let out a relieved breath that his father at least recognized him today. His relief was to be short-lived, as Magnus continued. "How is it that such profane creatures are allowed to exist on Morningstar?"
"This is not Morningstar, my lord," said Amon.
Magnus's eye darkened.
"Why must you always argue with me, Amon?"
"You taught me that truth was the highest virtue."
Thunder crashed over the mountains, and shards of glass fell from the highest peaks. The Legion's adoptive homeworld was tearing itself apart in an echo of Prospero's death.
"Why are you lying?"
"I do not lie, my lord,"
said Amon, fighting to keep the sorrow from his voice and shouting to be heard over the storm.
"This is not Morningstar, nor Shrike, nor Prospero. This world accepts no name other than the planet of the sorcerers."
"You keep saying that, but it is not true,"
snapped Magnus.
"These are the mountains of dust. This city was Zarukin."
This last name puzzled Amon, for unlike the others, it was not one he knew. Something about it was familiar, but his normally infallible memory could not connect the name with any recollection he possessed.
"No, my lord,"
said Amon, as his father advanced through the rain with purposeful strides.
"This city has no name. No one knows where it came from or how these beasts found their way here."
"Stop lying!" roared Magnus,
and Amon threw up a kind shield to deflect the Primarch's anger. Stone cracked around him, and glittering motes filled the air as the nearest menhirs split with the sound of thunder. Magnus towered over him and said,
"Gather the Legion, Amon. My father needs us at his side."
"I cannot,"
said Amon, fully aware of the risks he ran in confronting his father's fracturing soul with painful truths. Three times already Magnus had almost killed him, but no other means to bring him back to himself had proved effective.
"Why not?"
demanded Magnus.
because most of them are dead. The wolves of Russ slew them when they burned Prospero. His kind shield splintered as Magnus picked him up bodily with one ruddy clawed hand. Amon's father slammed him against the cracked menhir, and such was the ferocity he saw in his eye, it was as though Angron himself held him.
"You dare insult my brother!" roared Magnus. "Russ is a warrior of honour. He would never turn on us."
"He did, my lord! The Sixth Legion fell upon Prospero as our executioners," gasped Amon, as Magnus's grip on his throat tightened.
"At least clothe your lies with a veneer of plausibility, Amon," said Magnus. "What reason could Layman Russ possibly have for setting his warriors loose upon us?"
Amon struggled to form an answer, but Magnus dropped him and turned away, his hands clutching his head.
"No!"
cried Magnus, and Amon climbed to his feet, his armor clogged with blood-soaked mud.
"I don't believe you. I cannot believe you. To believe what you say is true is to accept the unacceptable."
"You have to come back to me, my lord,"
said Amon, daring to reach out and place a hand on his father's shoulder. The immaterial flesh was hot to the touch, as though the effort of remembering the truth of the galaxy was burning Magnus from within.
"I can feel their pain,"
said Magnus, sinking to his knees.
"Whose pain, my lord?"
"All of them. My brothers, my father. Is it too late for us? It was within our grasp. All it would have taken was one more step. All of us could have taken it together."
"Please, father," said Amon, "come back to me. You are Magnus the Red, and you are too strong to fade like this. The truth is painful. It is jagged edges and wicked barbs, but it is real."
"I can no longer tell what is real and what is invention,"
said Magnus, his towering form no longer as awesome and magisterial as before.
"Everything grows further away from me. I reach for things I should know, but they retreat into the mist. I'm losing it all, Amon. Why can't I remember?"
"Because you are split from yourself,"
said Amon. "But Ahriman leads a cabal of warriors in search of your splintered soul shards." Magnus's eye widened, and he shook his head violently at the mention of the Legion's chief librarian.
"No!"
cried Magnus, surging to his feet.
"No, Throne, no!
You must be whole again, please!"
Magnus turned and staggered away, as a deafening blast of thunder obscured his next words. He raged at the storm as if daring it to strike him down. A blast of zigzagging lightning split the sky. It arced to the ground and detonated within the body of the avian statue. The stones toppled into a pile of fused rubble, and a core of fulgurite, like a forked dagger, fell from its interior. Thunder crashed across the tortured sky, and Amon lurched through the mud and rain after his anguished father. The servitors followed him, still dragging the floating throne in their wake. Magnus once again drew his kopesh and lifted it high above his head.
"Do it! Do it now! Kill me!"
"No!"
cried Amon, as another fork of lightning speared downwards, and this time it struck Magnus. It blasted into the golden blade and through the Primarch's body in a searing explosion. Magnus toppled to the ground, his armor fused and blackened, his immaterial flesh smoking and burned. Amon rushed to his genesire's side and caught him as he fell. He went down in the mire, his eyes wet with rain and tears. Magnus tried to speak through blackened lips and bubbling flesh, but the words were unintelligible. His eye was a fused and molten ruin, unseeing and so terribly lost.
"Here! Now!"
he yelled at the servitors. Amon lifted his father from the ground, grief-stricken at how light and insubstantial he felt. The servitors obeyed and activated their device's life-preserving mechanisms.
You will endure,"
said Amon, placing the withered, metastasized form of Magnus into the support throne. The soul shard of Magnus within Ahriman's staff had set the Osiris Panthea's course, but offered no clues as to its final destination. Ahriman's suspicion of where the black ship was taking them had grown to a certainty the instant the vessel translated from the great ocean. Every fibre of his being sang with dreadful anticipation of returning to Nykaia. Shipboard horologs were conflicted on how long the Osiris Panthea had sailed the great ocean to get here. Months or years, it was impossible to know. The stars in this region of space were askew and unfamiliar. No chart in the Osiris Panthea's cartography database had a match for any of the local suns. For all intents and purposes, this region of space was unexplored. And yet the thousand suns knew this world well. The journey towards Nakia from the Mandeville Point had taken many weeks, with every day feeling like a lifetime, every warrior filled with a mixture of fevered anticipation and dread. None of them relished the thought of returning to this place of judgment. Their legion had been publicly humbled, and their Primarch brought to heel by a cowardly cabal of faithless brothers. No, a return to Nakia was most unwelcome. Abandoning the black ship, they dropped through the turbulent atmosphere in the back of a Stormbird, and Ahriman was acutely aware of the black mirror of fate in which this descent was reflected. He had last come to Nakia with hope, which had been cruelly dashed. Now he came with hope he would die to fulfill. His nascent cabal flew with him in the lead Stormbird, Tolbeck, Hathormat, and Sanakt. Afogoman's entirely blackened and rusted form sat apart from them. Even Camille Shivani descended to the surface with them. If today was to be the last act of this hunt, then Ahriman would face it with every asset at his disposal. At the far end of the troop compartment, Lucius sat glaring down the compartment to the cockpit, where Sanakt flew them to the surface. Ahriman had heard of the battle the two swordsmen had fought on the Osiris Panthea's bridge, and how Sanakt had ended the duel by slicing Lucius diagonally across his face from temple to chin. Two other Stormbirds flew in loose formation with his own, bearing all the warriors they could muster. One gunship bore the terminators of the Scarab occult, led by Onuris Hex, as well as the Ankh-Haru blades of Mamunim. The second carried Ignis and his Order of Ruin, together with Caillou's Sun Scarabs and the Feathered Ones of Nyctius. Ahriman was restless and rose from the armoured bench seat, holding on to hanging straps and stanchions to make his way to the cockpit. He looked out through the armour glass. Rain streaked the glass, black like the rain that poured during Prospero's demise. Ahriman scanned the slate-grey skies, but seeing nothing beyond ashen clouds and roiling storm fronts, he returned his attention to the volcanic ground. The geometric landscape spread before him, jet black and primordial. "The genesis of a world," said Ahriman, in unconscious echo of his genesire's words. "How like our father to return to this place. The echoes of what happened here must have pulled him back, forcing him to relive his greatest shame on a planetary canvas." The cubes, spheres, and fluted columns of extruded stone on the surface had been shattered by what looked like the handiwork of a vengeful god. Ahriman recognized the continent-cracking aftermath of a planetary bombardment in the thousands of overlapping impact craters, mass-driver gouges, and vitrified canyons carved by macro-lasers. Ahriman risked a glance over his shoulder as the shattered flanks of a partially collapsed stratovolcano emerged from the sheeting rain. Once it had pierced the clouds and boasted a vast amphitheatre at its heart, but its soaring, steep-sided flanks had been blasted inwards, transforming it into a slumped pyramid of fused tephra and blackened basalt. Psychic light burned at its heart, piercing the sky like a beacon and gleaming through the clouds, just as it had before.
"We are not the first to reach this place," said Sanakt.
"I know," said Ahriman.
Dark rain fell over the shattered ruins of the amphitheatre, making the basalt rocks glisten in the flickering lightning. Weeks of bombardment from orbit had permanently soured the planet's atmosphere, seeding it with heavy metals that gave the air a bitter metallic taste that filled every breath with the tang of swallowed blood. Guilt hung over Diopromus like a shroud, a weight of failure he had never managed to shed, no matter how many times he told himself that Magnus had fooled them all. Was this spot close to where he had stood and voiced his support of the Crimson King in the face of his accusers? Impossible to tell. The senior librarians of many legions had spoken to the character of Magnus the Red,
painting a picture of a visionary whose only motive was the betterment of mankind. What had become of those warriors? Fell Zarost and Umogen were now like him, warriors without a legion and shadow agents of the regent. But of the others, he knew only rumours. Targutai Yeshugai had gone to rejoin his legion, fighting the Greenskins, his eventual fate unknown. Elikas of the First Legion. Who could say? The Lion's warriors were a mystery even to themselves. Of the rest, he knew almost nothing, but he feared the worst. They had reached Nykaia less than 10 hours ago, pushing the Arethusa and Doramar hard to arrive before the Thousand Suns. It had proven to be a risk worth taking, as space around this cursed world was deserted, save for the wrecks of the guidance barges employed during the bombardment. The fire-gutted hulks were circling in ever-decaying orbits, amid a low-hanging umbra of protean dust kicked up by the detonations. In the normal run of things, it would be foolish to believe that two separate groups might meet here at even vaguely the same time. The vagaries of warp travel ensured that any such rendezvous could only be made with margins of error in the region of months or years. Yet Diopromus knew with frightening certainty that it would not be long before the Thousand Suns arrived at this place of judgment. They would find Promus and his warriors awaiting them. In essence, his plan was simple. Use the soul shards within Lemuel as bait to lure the Thousand Suns to the surface, while Antaka Saivan hunted down and destroyed their ship in orbit. When the Thousand Suns' means of escape was cut off, Magos Araxi would kill Lemuel. Then Promus and the others would kill Ahriman's warriors. He was under no illusions that this plan had only the slimmest possibility of success, but with few other practicals, it was the best they had.
"They are coming," said Nagasena,
two fingers pressed to the Voxspeed in his ear that linked him to the Doramar. Watching three distant spots of light moving through the clouds towards the amphitheatre, Promus nodded.
"I know," he said.
The great amphitheatre had been wrought as a palace of wonders, but repurposed by the Emperor into a place of bitter judgment. The stonework was imbued with null properties, but compared to the inhibiting power of the Osiris Panthea, these were practically negligible. Ahriman led his cabal and warriors through the rain-lashed ruins to where the hunters awaited. They moved swiftly, 33 of them, eager to be done with this place. He felt the auras of the warriors awaiting them like candle flames. Most flickered low and wavering, but others burned with numinous intensity. Some he had felt on Committee Sona, others were unknown to him. One figure, blurred in the rain but blazing within a light, was unmistakable. The power within Ahriman's staff pulled him towards this figure like a magnet. His heart beat faster, recognizing there could only be one explanation for such an attraction. Yet there was more than just this presence that drew him on. Ahriman sensed something greater, something more powerful deep in the heart of Nykaia. Another soul shard, or something else entirely? The path led them onto a rubble-choked plateau that had once been the floor of the arena. His mind's eye filled in the tiered bench seats from which their accusers had spouted their fear-mongering lies, and the podium upon which Malkador had levelled charges of sorcery. And there were the ruins of the Grand Pavilion, where the Emperor had passed judgment upon Magnus. The Thousand Suns spread out, forming unfurled wings to either side of Ahriman and his cabal. A ragtag band of warriors stood before them. Fingers slipped around triggers and onto the activation runes of swords. It would take only the slightest spark to turn this arena into a battlefield. The simmering prospect of violence hung tantalizingly on the air. Ahriman took stock of the enemies ranged against them. His gaze was immediately drawn to a towering, orange-lacquered automaton, holding a seething form he barely recognized by the neck. The vividness of the psychic might haloing the captive figure almost obscured his identity, but Ahriman would have recognized Lemuel Gaumon anywhere. This was the source of the attraction,
and Ahriman blanched as he felt the inhuman power coursing through his former neophyte's body. A priest of the Mechanicum he did not know stood next to the automaton, his withered body supported within a complex steel framework and suspensor fields. His aura spoke of great courage, masking a terrible and growing fear of his body's degeneration. Ahriman sent a pulse of questioning thought towards Hathor Mart, who gave a slow nod in return.
"Then begin," he sent.
The rune priest, Viarki, and his remaining wolves stood to the left of the automata, and anger touched Ahriman as he saw Menkaura on his knees before a wolf with a hideously burned face. A spiked collar shackled his friend and blunted his powers. An armored figure stood between Menkaura and Lemuel, one whose outline was a hateful void in the world and marked her as one of the Silent Sisterhood. A swordsman clad in armor of the Dragon Nations stood protectively by a woman who dropped to her knees at the sight of Camille. Ahriman recognized Chaya's face from the many times he had trawled Mistress Shivani's mind. But it was to another legionary in rain-washed silver plate that Ahriman's gaze was drawn, for his aura was not unknown to him.
"You are Promus of the 13th, said Ahriman.
"I am. But Ultramar no longer has the highest claim on my loyalty."
"Once I would have said such a thing was impossible."
"And I would have agreed with you."
"You spoke in defense of the Crimson King," continued Ahriman,
seeing the wolves flinch at his mention of Promus's previous support for Magnus. Was that a wedge he could drive between them?
"Yes," said a voice in his head he recognized as Aphagomon's. "But I have a wedge that will drive deeper than any you might devise."
"You spoke with great eloquence and unimpeachable logic," said Ahriman. "I thank you for that."
"Yes, I spoke in support of Magnus. But do not think to use that against me. Not a day goes by without me wishing I had kept silent. Your Primarch lied that day and betrayed us all."
Ahriman planted his staff on the cracked stone floor of the arena and pointed to Lemuel.
"You have something that does not belong to you," he said. "I would see it returned."
Promus stepped forwards and shook his head.
"Arzak Ahriman, I name you Traitoris Excommunicate, an enemy of the Imperium and a faithless son of the Emperor. Prepare to die."
Ahriman turned to Lucius, and the swordsman flinched as Ahriman's voice echoed within his skull.
"Be swift," he sent. "Please," said Lucius. "It's me."
The nullifying properties of Nykeia's arena have been smashed by the bombardment. Complex geomantic arrangements of psychically inert materials have been blown to dust, and only the lingering traces of its power remained. To a warrior whose powers have been honed to a razor's edge in the belly of a black ship, this was nothing. Hathor Mart's power was a subtle knife in the mind of the mortal Ahriman had indicated, a scalpel that softly reimagined the architecture of his neocortex. He did not rush his work, nor did he employ more power than was necessary. Excessive force would alert the Imperial Psykers that something was amiss within one of their allies. The decay of the meat within the man's skull repelled Hathor Mart. He was dying, but more than that, his every waking moment was consumed with the terror of his body's betrayal. No better crack in armor than fear. Hathor Mart plunged deep into the mind and body of Magos Umwelt Uexkul, undoing the damage done by the neurodegenerative disease and restoring life to dead cells and atrophied muscles. In the blink of an eye, he undid years of decay and sickness. Muscles swelled with new growth, and Hathor Mart felt hope flare in the man's mind. After fear, hope is the final twist of the knife. Now he withdrew his power, and the creeping malady returned like a black corruption, an invisible battle fought at the cellular level. Hathor Mart felt the man's terror and poured power into him, driving back the disease once more. Over and over again, he alternated curing and afflicting him, each act of healing accompanied by a whispered seduction. He was dimly aware of Ahriman's voice beyond the shell of bone in which he worked, but paid little attention to it. Whatever he was saying was irrelevant, simply a means to distract their enemies and give Hathor Mart time to bait the hook of betrayal. Uexkul experienced his potential futures over and over at the speed of thought. He saw his body's final, inevitable fall to the dreadful affliction. Hathor Mart projected images of Uexkul lying twisted and soiled in a fused ball, abandoned by his fellow adepts as being too disgusting and too hideous to be around. He was a burden, cared for by only rancid, meat-bodied servitors until his body could endure no more and finally ended its wretched, pain-filled existence. Hathor Mart poured his own terror of mutation and decay into this assault on Uexkul's mind, raising the man's fear to inhuman levels. Then he unveiled his temptation. Hathor Mart showed Uexkul as tall and powerful, blessed with physical perfection, and a body that could resist all forms of disease and cellular entropy. Flesh that would never fail him, never weaken or become infirm. A body raised up as a god amongst men.
"Please," cried Uexkul within his own skull, "heal me."
"I will," promised Hathor Mart. "But I require something of you."
"Anything."
"Anything?"
"Heal me and I am yours."
Lucius had never met another warrior his equal in terms of speed. Yes, Sanact was proficient. The scar bisecting his face was proof of that. But his skill with the blade was enhanced by precognitive powers. Even Nykona Sharukin, the little raven who had killed him on the world of the fictive Angel Exterminatus, had been trained to wield powers beyond any normal warrior. But in the end, neither was as naturally swift as Lucius. He dived forwards, rolling to one knee and snapping his left arm out. The barbed whip unravelled from his wrist like the lashing tongue of an insectile predator. It cracked the air like a gunshot. The finely tapered end of the whip coiled around Sister Caesaria's neck like a garrote. Spiteful thorns swelled as Lucius wrenched his arm back like a slamming piston. Barbs and razor-fine edges tore through meat and metal. Blood fountained as Caesaria's head fell from her shoulders, and the greater portion of her pariah powers died with her. Promus watched Sister Caesaria fall, her helmeted head rolling away into the rubble. He ducked for cover and shouted over to the robotic form of Magus Araxi.
"Kill Lemuel!" he roared. "Do it now!"
But the piston-driven arm didn't crush Lemuel's neck. Instead, it released him. Araxi's robot body turned towards Magus Uexkul, and even though it possessed no features to which human emotions could be ascribed, Promus sensed its confusion. Its limbs juddered as it attempted to move. How had Magus Araxi's cybernetic body failed him? A moment later, he knew. Beneath the steelwork struts of Uexkul's gibbet harness, Promus saw his previously waxy, grey and dying body was now smooth and pink. He tasted sorcery on the air, hidden by Sister Caesaria's power until now. Biaki smelt the same thing and understood the significance of Uexkul's transformation a fraction of a second quicker than Promus.
"Maleficarum!"
cried Biaki, swinging his frost blade in a short, brutal arc. Driven by all the fury and power of Fenris, Biaki's weapon clove Uexkul from shoulder to groin. Blood and oil sprayed as the betrayer's body fell to the rock of Nykaia, but the damage had already been done. Lemuel stood unmolested before Magus Araxi, his body seething with newly unfettered power. He lifted from the rocky ground, gobbets of light dripping from his feet like molten glass. Promus swung his bolter to bear on the host flesh of Magnus's soul shards. He snapped off a shot as dozens of weapons blazed. In an instant, the space between the two forces was a hellstorm of gunfire. Yet none of it reached its intended target. Scores of mass reactives hung motionless in the air.
"No," said Lemuel, rising farther into the air. "This won't be settled by crude bullets and primitive blades. Not when there are so many buried secrets and revelations to be had."
Promus squeezed the trigger of his weapon again, but it refused to fire. He looked over at Biaki, who shrugged and shook his head. The Thousand Suns looked equally surprised, stunned into immobility at this turn of events. Had they not expected this? Lemuel drifted higher, beyond the reach of any on the ground. Etherfire wreathed his upraised limbs and cascaded from his body like sparks in a foundry.
"These ruins are ill-suited to so grand a moment!"
shouted Lemuel, his eyes of cold fire sweeping the warriors below with inhuman disdain.
"Such dramas as are to unfold for each of us demand a grander setting!"
Dark rain boiled around Lemuel as he lifted yet higher and brought his arms down like the conductor of a grand orchestra at the moment of crescendo. The basalt floor of the arena bucked, heaving upwards as the rocks split apart and newly wrought structures speared towards the sky. Bladed pillars of geometric stone punched upwards with ferocious speed, showering the warriors below in shards heaved from the very depths of the planet. Choking veils of dust billowed as gleaming walls of crystal and glass arose, forcing the legionaries in their path to separate or be crushed by their ascension. Promus vaulted the emerging walls and rising outcroppings of tessellated black stone as he ran towards Biarki and his men.
"Behold the crystalline labyrinth!"
shouted Lemuel. A city was being raised here. Tapered obelisks and walls of glass, ranging from transparent to opaque, and variations in between. Promus and the others were at the centre of a titanic structure, its every plane angular and sharp-edged. Mirrored walls formed an ever-growing pyramid of dark and smoky glass that rippled as if stained with fuliginous oil. An ancient necropolis was surfacing, like a city submerged beneath an ocean for eons, and now emerging from its long entombment. It was a dark inversion of a place once famed for its wonders and miracles. It took Promus a moment to connect what he was seeing here with what he had only read about in Remembrance's verse or after-action reports. "This is Tisca," he said.
"No,"
said Biarki, before he and his warriors were obscured by rising crystal walls.
"This is the Underverse,"